Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Corn emergence advancing 10 percentage points during the week to reach 88% overall by June 12th. That is 1 point behind the five-year average, but substantially further behind last year's progress, which was 95% emerged on June 12th.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Again, focusing on the far upper Midwest, Minnesota having a respectable advance, 19 percentage points emerging during the week to reach 85% overall. That's still behind the average of 94%. And then remarkably in North Dakota, even with a 28 percentage point increase in emergence during the week ending June 12th, only half of the acreage emerged on that date, far behind the five-year average of 83%.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Not too many surprises across the whole WASDE report, and the markets really didn't respond too dramatically to it.
Guy Allen is the director of the International Grains Program. Looking at the wheat situation,
world wheat production down just to 1.5 million metric tons at 774 million metric tons. That's below last year's record crop of 779 million metric tons, but still a good number. We might walk through some of the changes of that production number. They're the largest wheat producer in the world. Their number came in steady at about 135 million metric tons. So China's number came in pretty much steady compared to May, came in at about 135 million metric tons compared to 137 million metric tons last year. Another big wheat producer out there that we're watching quite closely is India. They came in at 106 million metric tons, down 2.5 million from the previous month's report and 3.6 million tons below last year. Some positive changes. Australia's production came in at about 30 million metric tons. That's about where their local Abair put it last week as well. They're expecting to have a very good year, probably their fourth largest year. I think it might even be their third largest year, following their largest crop and their second largest crop in the last 2 years. Quite a turnaround from the drought. So they're quite optimistic on wheat production there in Australia. Their biggest challenge is going to be their supply chain restrictions and just their export capacity. And I think their export volumes are sort of booked out all the way till first quarter of 2023. Canadian production is up following the drought last year. It was unchanged from last month at 33 million metric tons. That's up from last year's 24 million metric tons on that drought-affected crop there. Now, Russia, being the largest wheat exporter, they're expected to have a near-record crop of 81 million metric tons with record exports of 40 million metric tons, which is the highest ever. That's up a million metric tons from May and up 7 million metric tons from last year. We've got good production, but we also have very strong demand, and we've seen wheat stocks tighten up enough that, as I've said for some time now, we can't afford to price wheat into that feed ration. It's going to stay at a good premium to corn and other feed grains, and we're just running pretty close to the wind on that, and I continue to think corn's going to be the big driver on that.
That's the wheat situation. What about corn?
Corn, really not too many changes to highlight there. Global coarse grains outputs up 3.3 million metric tons from last month and 5.1 million tons higher than last year. That came in at 1,479 million metric tons. One of the key drivers of that increase is the Ukraine's is getting more corn planted than what we expected. The challenge for the Ukraine is going to be their capacity to actually move that corn or that grain to market, as that unrest and that situation between Russia and the Ukraine continues to hang over those whole Black Sea markets and that whole export supply chain.
And, of course, eyes are on China.
China's used to buy a significant volume of wheat, corn, and oil seeds from that Black Sea area. And now with the shipping challenges there, they're aggressively seeking alternative supplies. Just last week with Brazil, they signed an agreement to make it a bit easier to import a number of grain types from Brazil. And China's not the only country looking to do that. A lot of countries are seeking alternative supplies, and that's really having an impact on the ocean freight markets, which we'll talk about a bit later.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Social Security is, I think, as everybody knows, one of the most popular and successful government programs in the history of our nation.
Bernie Sanders is the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee.
For more than 80 years, in good times and bad, Social Security has paid out every benefit owed to every eligible American on time and without delay. And I think it's important to make that point. We live in a moment of great insecurity, and yet Social Security, since its inception, has never failed the American people and remains a program enormously important to them and one that they can rely upon. Not once over more than eight decades of operation, not during the pandemic that we're in, not during the Wall Street crash, has anyone ever received a letter or a phone call from the Social Security Administration saying, sorry, the economy is not doing well, we need to cut your benefits. Never happened. And if I have anything to say about it, it never will happen.
Lindsey Graham from South Carolina is the ranking member.
The bottom line is we're going to have to make some hard decisions. I stand ready to make those hard decisions. Senator Romney has been terrific. Senator Romney wants somebody outside of politics to give us some information, like we have with Simpson Bowles, like we have with the Gang of Six, to adjust Social Security and stop it from running out of money by 2034 and having to reduce benefits. And I think he and others on our side, and people on your side, quite frankly, are willing to do this. And I would invite President Biden to be part of it. I would love to be able to sit down with the administration and see if we can recreate the momentum for Simpson Bowles or the Gang of Six, where we put on the table something of everything, where everybody has to give a little bit to save a system worth saving. So if this is an election year issue, great. I think it needs to be talked about, and we're going to talk about it in terms on our side that is a little more holistic than just tax the rich.
Shai Acabas is director of the Bipartisan Policy Center.
The recent trustees report contains some sobering conclusions. To ensure solvency of the combined trust funds through the 75-year projection period, Congress would need to immediately raise the payroll tax rate by more than 3 percentage points, reduce benefits for all current and future beneficiaries by around 20%, or adopt some combination of those approaches. If policymakers wait, much larger changes will be required. The alternative is an unprecedented departure from the pay-as-you-go structure of Social Security, were Congress to begin allowing the program to permanently draw from general government revenue. This would sacrifice Social Security's special status as the program walled off from the rest of the budget, making it compete for resources with other priorities at a time when the nation's fiscal house is already in rough shape. This would be irresponsible policymaking. Before outlining possible solutions, I want to describe the two principles that must guide any reforms to the program. One, acting as soon as possible is paramount. The longer Congress waits to strengthen Social Security's finances, the more drastic the changes will have to be, and the more burden will fall upon those who played little or no role in creating the imbalance facing the program today. The lack of action by policymakers is also especially unfair to the millions of Americans who are trying to plan for their retirement. Failing to enact reforms will simply kick the can down the road, pushing responsibility for a long-term solution onto future lawmakers, who will have to decide between inconceivable benefit cuts, impractical tax increases, or the abandonment of the program's historical financing mechanism. Number two, any legislative action must garner significant bipartisan support. Working across the aisle is not only generally best practice for enacting durable policies, but also a necessity for changes to Social Security, which requires a supermajority in the Senate. Lawmakers should abstain from pronouncements like no new tax increases and no benefit cuts, whether they apply across the board or for certain subsets of the population. Red lines such as these only put obstacles in the way of action. Social Security's financial challenge affects nearly our entire society, and the solutions will require a broad-based approach.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Overall, pretty positive week. We've seen futures prices were up anywhere from $1 to $2, depending on what contract we look at.
Lee Schultz is a livestock economist, Iowa State University.
You know, some relative strength in cash prices. You know, we still see that the spread between the north and the south. Here in the north, you know, we've seen prices in that 142 to 143 range. You know, south, we were in the upper 130s on that cash basis. Give you some perspective, a year ago, we were trading in the 120 range for live cattle prices. Really, when in feeder cattle, you know, there, I think it was kind of a steady week. And really reacting to the much higher corn prices we've seen overall.
On boxed beef,
Well, I think we're seeing the topping of the box beef as we would expect seasonally here, as we're really kind of in that ramping up the summer grilling season, and now we expect to kind of get in some of those dog days of summer as we get into the next several months. I would expect this to see some stair-stepping lower as we get into the box beef trade. Now, we've seen rather robust slaughter levels, and I think that is helping continue to hold some of those prices where they're at. Obviously, that's trickling through into Fed cattle prices. So again, I'd summarize it as a pretty positive week. You know, if we look back a couple of weeks, I think the optimism has certainly improved.
We often talk about exports, but what is the real value for a producer?
I like to boil it down to a number that the U.S. Meat Export Federation calculates. And so they calculate an export value generated, and they put it on a per head basis or a per steer basis. And their last calculation was $489.59. This was the second highest on record. So if you just do some quick math, that, you know, a steer is maybe about $1,680, $1,700. You know, that's 30% of the value, it shows you, of that export market. And so realizing how important that export market is, the growth in that export and maintaining that demand is very critical to the prices. As we look at the next several years of those tighter supplies, you know, we're going to expect to see those higher prices being paid, and that's going to generate that higher value that's allowing us to see the increased prices for the steers.
And finally, what's ahead for the feeding sector?
Certainly, we had some delayed plantings. You know, we did get a lot planted, and crop progress has certainly improved year to date here. But I think, you know, there's been some cooler weather, some, you know, emergence issues. You know, in this part of the world, we've seen some flooding that's really impacted some of those acres of corn planted. So I think there's certainly some challenges that are currently existing and certainly going to exist going forward. You don't have to look any further than looking at the futures prices of where those corn markets are, right? Those are both supply related as we talk about some of these challenges, but also demand related, that we have relatively large inventories of animals, and that feed demand, export demand, all that is continuing to be really strong and giving us these high values. You know, just still what this means when you look at cost of production, cost of gain, you know, those are again, in some uncharted territory we've seen here in those values for producers. So what does that mean kind of short term? You know, I think we are seeing much lighter weights of cattle, and certainly because those last few pounds, they're less efficient to put on, and you're putting it on at $7 corn, that's impacted producers' willingness or ability to do that. So that's the short-term fix. You know, longer-term challenges, you know, those are much higher costs of gain over all those pounds. That's going to make it much, much more costly for producing those animals. It's going to obviously impact break-evens and profitability for producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Oil seeds, really pretty much a non-event there. We had slightly higher production in both Brazil and Argentina, and really no changes into the imports.
Digging deeper into USDA's World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report, Guy Allen with the International Grains Program.
China imports were pretty much unchanged, 92 million metric tons for this year, 99 million tons for next year. China's the key buyer. They import nearly two-thirds of global oilseed trade goes to China. And again, the big thing hanging over China is, one is just that African swine fever situation and what is their livestock demand. But the other significant thing that's happening in China is their COVID lockdown. Shanghai's been locked down for some time, and they recently sort of loosened it up. But there's 40 other major cities that are locked down, and that's really having an impact on that domestic demand for meat and foodstuffs.
But what's driving the demand?
The big driver in this whole oilseed complex has been the vegetable oil side of it. It used to be, you know, meal was the big driver, and we always had a surplus capacity for oil. But with this recent demand that we've seen coming from the energy sector for biofuels and biodiesel, we've seen oil prices just remain historically strong. That in the wake of sort of waning palm oil production, and we've seen some export restrictions put on by Indonesia. They've sort of loosened that up. Thing we need to remember about palm oil: a palm oil tree once it's planted, is in production for about 20 to 25 years. So it's not like soybeans where you can change the crop every year, but once it's in production, you continue to produce it. And the trade sort of anticipated that loosening of export supplies because basically they were running out of places to store the palm oil.
And when we talk about competition, what about Australia?
Hebear came out with their report last week. Hebear is forecasting a fourth largest winter crop production on record. They're forecasting 3.3 million metric tons of barley, 30.3 million metric tons of wheat. Sorghum production is expected to be the second largest ever at 5.6 million metric tons, and I think a lot of that shift in acreage into canola has been driven by the attractive oilseed price, as well as the Chinese embargo on or tariff, 80% tariff on barley out of Australia has really seen barley acres start to wane a bit the last couple of years.
Australia just a few years ago dealing with some devastating drought, but today...
Yeah, we say down there, like everywhere, rain makes grain, and they've had another third season in a row of a very good start to the season. A lot of areas which usually don't get planted in the western edge of the eastern grain belt will be planted this year. So I remain optimistic that they'll probably come in slightly higher than what the current Hebear numbers show. Their summer crops are just coming off. Their summer crops of sorghum and cotton, their primary crops, are going to be a record 5.5 million metric tons. Sorghum makes up about half of that at 2.7 million tons. And the export of that sorghum coming out of Australia at the moment is keeping a bit of pressure on U.S. sorghum prices at the moment, as we've seen sorghum values sort of fall back a bit relative to corn.
And what about sorghum?
The last 2 years, we've seen probably 95% of U.S. production of grain sorghum move to China, driven primarily by that domestic market. And I think it's hard to know for sure, but probably about two-thirds of that's going in that domestic Baijiu market, which is keeping prices very, very strong and at a good premium to corn for the last 2 years.
And this is Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
So it's, I don't want to get too in the weeds on the policy, but it's not like a benefit cut. Raising the retirement age is a benefit cut, 7% for each year you raise it.
Recent hearing in the Senate Budget Committee on Social Security, Alex Lawson is Executive Director of Social Security Works.
So raising the retirement age to 70 is just a 21% benefit cut. But it also has the added terribleness that it's putting the pressure not on millionaires and billionaires who are doing fine in this country, but on working people, on people working on the line, teachers, people who are on their feet, backbreaking laborers, saying, oh, well, you're going to have to now work until you die. So you can't overstate how bad that effect would be on the American people.
Ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham.
The bottom line is somebody's got to bring us together. I don't think it's to be Mr. Lawson. So what I want to do is be brought together in a fashion like people before us. Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill adjusted the age from 65 to 67, and it did buy us some time. That alone's not enough. Let's look at maybe doing it once again because we live longer. And if we don't need to do it, great. Count me in for raising the cap on income subject to Social Security taxation within reason. I don't want to have like 70% tax rates in America. But also count me in for people in my income level and my financial situation taking a smaller COLA or maybe a restructured benefit because I can afford it. That's what it's going to take to save Social Security. It's not going to be fixed by taxing the wealthy. That can be part of it. So I'm hoping, Senator Sanders, that we will have a vote of your plan and Senator Romney's plan, but then get on about the hard work of finding a solution that will get buy-in from both sides of the aisle. I really do believe it's possible if there's political will.
Maya McGinnis is president for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
Thank you, Senator Van Hollen. I think that's a great point. I think that makes sense. Senator Sanders should be commended for putting forth a plan that reaches, I think, 75-year solvency. I haven't seen the details yet, but that's great. I would quibble with a lot of details, but agreed. So we could have another plan from the Republican side and work to come up with the compromises because it absolutely does have to be bipartisan. We can't get this done with just one party or the other. The only thing I would say, and this comes from my observations of this hearing, is that there is so much talk about us and them. There is so much performative exaggeration on this podium that we have sat through. And our country is so polarized, and we are in such trouble right now. I'd really like to sit down with a group of Republicans and Democrats and work on this together as well. So I appreciate all you've done on this for many, many years. And I think that proposal is great. We would work with any Republicans to come up with a proposal. But it's also time to do this as members of Congress who are the fiduciaries for the program. That's my plea to all of you.
And Senator Rick Scott from Florida.
I propose that Congress regularly review all these programs. Of course, some of my colleagues and some of the people testifying today have decided to lie about what I've been proposing. So let's be clear. I'm never going to support cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And outside of Joe Biden, I don't know too many other folks in Washington that want to see these programs be cut or go away either. Some of the panelists may not know that Congress regularly reviews essential programs and functions of the federal government and should regularly review essential programs and functions of the federal government. As you know, we don't even vote on Social Security and on Medicare, which makes no sense. For 61 consecutive years, Congress has successfully passed the National Defense Authorization Act. The NDA sets the budget for the entire Department of Defense. It is a critical series of must-pass national security and defense budget laws that Congress has never failed to approve, not even once. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid are no different.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
When I look at CPI that was just released last week, and it's the May data, and so we are always lagged in looking at that data. So realizing that, you know, a lot of the higher gas prices we've seen the last couple of weeks wouldn't be fully captured in some of those CPI numbers for May.
Talking Consumer Price Index. That's Lee Schultz, Iowa State livestock economist.
But as we look at CPI for year over year, changes was up 8.6%. To give you some perspective, this is the highest since December 1981. So we're really kind of in uncharted territory as it relates to kind of recentness as we look at some of those levels. It was a slight tick higher than the previous month. And so, you know, inflation continues to be the story. When we focus in on looking at meats in particular, that was up 12.3% year over year. That's a slightly lower than the April year over year increase. So I'm not ready to say that we're starting to see these prices lower, but maybe we're starting to see a little bit of stabilization there. Now, realizing that, you know, demand's not impacted by the prices that consumers are paying for those particular products. And I would say, you know, a positive signal for demand is, remember, it's what consumers are able and willing to pay. And so far, so good. They've been really willing to pay these higher prices. And so, you know, what I think a real barometer for demand is going to be here as we get into the next several months. We know that demand's really strongest as we're in these, you know, ramp up to Memorial Day and post-Memorial Day into Father's Day. And you'll get a little bit of kick as you get into 4th of July. But after that, we got a long period into Labor Day. And so I think that's going to be the real litmus test of what demand is and how much of that strength continues to go forward.
A bright spot for sure, increasing exports.
This export data, this is what I like to refer to as more the official data. So this was out of USDA and summarized greatly by U.S. Meat Export Federation. And it's just the summary through April so far, so the first 4 months of the year. But again, another really positive signal there. Exports were up 3% in April year over year from volume. It soared even higher at 33% by value. So when you think about demand, remember it's both the quantity and the price. Certainly price is driving a big part of that demand as we look at exports and as we look at our domestic product. You know, the April data, that's not going to capture some of these COVID restrictions that we've seen in China. Certainly, China's been a real star market, and I think that's something to watch as we get export data from May, June, and so forth of how much of that demand is impacted. I like to also pair that against our weekly data, which is through the first week in June, and there it shows, you know, that we're still holding 3% higher year to date in those exports. Now, I will note that as you look at the WASDE data that was also released last week, you know, for the year, they have us about similar to 2021 levels. So that's noting that I think, you know, we will see from a year-over-year standpoint, you know, less of the increases that we've seen so far this year. But overall, this is a positive story for exports, that we're holding these record levels that we've seen in 2021, even at these much higher prices that are being paid by our export customers.
And at the end of the day, he says he's optimistic.
Seeing a rather positive outlook. There's a lot of pieces that need to come into place, but I think, you know, we've certainly seen those values improve from what we've seen a couple of weeks ago.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Despite a showery week in the Midwest, we are approaching completion finally on the 2022 corn planting season.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says as of this past Sunday, nationally, corn growers had 97% of the crop in the ground. Probably by the time you hear this, it'll be 100%. Some growers have further to go than others. North Dakota growers still had 10% of their intended acreage unplanted. Corn emergence nationally, 88%. And the good news is that what has come up is looking, as Brad likes to say,
pretty good. Coming in this week at 72% good to excellent, just 5% very poor to poor.
Most of the condition issues coming from outside the main Corn Belt area, for example.
Texas, stricken by drought and heat, showing 30% of the corn acreage rated very poor to poor.
Texas leading the nation in poor corn condition ratings. Gary Crawford, Washington.